You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, following the desperate economic developments in Cyprus over the last week, we'll ring around some of the Eurozone's smaller countries to take their temperature. Paywalls, BuzzFeed, Doctor Who, we'll have a roundup of the biggest stories in the media sector this week.
A third of US dailies are now paywalled. And it does seem to be that there's a recognition that actually we all hoped that internet advertising was going to be able to pay for high quality content. That's maybe not happening.
After two decades, Thomas Menino, Boston's longest serving mayor, is stepping down. We'll assess his legacy. And we'll hear about two British institutions too, London's Tube Map and our preoccupation with the weather.
Interesting links began to form between my own psychological reflection of weather patterns and the natural world's reflection of the weather, and began to ask questions about why that might be.
More on that soon. Plus, we'll play some great tunes too. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, let's get the latest world headlines with David Spencer.
Monocle 24 News, I'm David Spencer. Former South African President Nelson Mandela is in hospital for further treatment on a recurring lung infection. He has been frail and in poor health for several years and was in hospital briefly earlier this month for a checkup and spent nearly 3 weeks in hospital in December with a lung infection after surgery to remove gallstones. Presidential spokesman Mac Maharaj has issued an update.
Former President Nelson Mandela is responding positively to the treatment he's receiving for a recurring lung infection. For the present, he remains under treatment and observation in hospital.
Cyprus says that tight capital controls will remain in force longer than expected as the island's banks reopened for the first time in 2 weeks. They were shut after the government was forced to accept a tough EU rescue package to avoid bankruptcy. Cypriots queued calmly to withdraw limited amounts of cash, but there was no sign of a run on deposits, as had been feared. Lawyers for Oscar Pistorius have successfully appealed for his bail conditions to be relaxed. The Olympic and Paralympic athlete will now be allowed to travel abroad and will no longer have to report to a probation officer. He's accused of murdering his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, at his home in Pretoria on February the 14th. Syrian media is reporting that mortar fires hit the University of Damascus, killing 15 students. Officials blamed rebels for the attack as fighting around the city continues. It has intensified this week with reports that rebel forces have escalated their use of mortars. The United Nations Refugee Agency, meanwhile, says it's very worried by reports of mass deportations of Syrians from Turkey. The Turkish government has denied a claim that it sent hundreds of refugees back to Syria after clashes with military police at their camp near the border in a protest over living conditions. Melissa Fleming from the UNHCR said the agency has had reports that the deportations followed a fire at the camp.
We're trying to clarify this with Turkish authorities. Deportations to Syria would be, if they occurred, against the principles of international law. And so we're very much hoping this didn't occur.
Boeing says it is confident that a proposed battery fix on its grounded 787 fleet will see the planes back in the air soon. But the manufacturer has described the grounding as frustrating. Regulators grounded all the planes in January after separate battery incidents on planes in the United States and Japan. It's already cost the company an estimated $450 million in lost income and compensation payments to airlines. Boeing is now running test flights to prove the safety of its new battery system. Chief Executive Officer Jim McNerney.
Tests will be completed in several days, and we'll all look at the data, and I have a high degree of confidence that that data will tell us and will tell the FAA, who are the decision makers here, that the fix is what we need it to be, and we'll get this airplane back in service in due time.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much for that, David. We'll be hearing from you again in 25 minutes. It's 18:05 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Now, the worst of the crisis may have passed in Cyprus, but the threat to Europe's economy remains. Already the sharks are circling around a number of other small countries with outsized economies. Jeroen Dijsselbloem, the Dutch finance minister and head of the Eurogroup, warned Malta, Luxembourg and Slovenia that they should deal with it before you get in trouble. So how big is the problem in each of those countries? Well, in a moment we'll speak to journalists in Malta and Slovenia, but let's begin our European tour of fragile economies in Luxembourg. Christian Müller is economics columnist at Tageblatt. Christian, thank you very much for joining us. Luxembourg's financial services are by far the biggest part of the country's economy. How worried should they be?
People should not be worried, to be precise. I mean, Luxembourg is one of the very few AAA-rated states left in Europe. It has a very stable, it has very low government debt. It has a very diversified financial sector, and there is no reason to be worried. But if you say that the financial sector is too big compared to its the size of its GDP, then it's the wrong comparison, because the EU is a single market, and Luxembourg, as part of a single market and being a small state, it has to focus on several places in the economic sphere. It cannot be doing, Luxembourg cannot be building cars, building satellites, and have a big financial sector.
But Christian, yesterday the Luxembourg government issued a two-page defence of its financial services industry, which would seem that they were trying to allay fears or fingers being pointed from other countries in the Eurozone. What exactly did the report say?
The report from the Luxembourgish government?
Yes.
It said that the Luxembourgish banks have a very high solvency rate, and it mainly said that you cannot compare Luxembourg to Cyprus, because Cyprus only has a very small number of banks, while in Luxembourg there are more than 140 banks which are active. Most of these banks are subsidiaries from German, English and French banks.
Well, Christian Müller from Tageblatt, thank you very much indeed. Now let's cross to Malta, where we're joined by Noel Greamer, editor of the Malta Independent. Noel, Malta's economy also seems to have a number of similarities with Cyprus's. Have people been watching events across the Mediterranean with trepidation?
Well, I think that the two countries are islands, and they are both in the Mediterranean. And that is as far as their similarities lie. Malta's economy and Malta's financial services sector is very, very different from that of Cyprus.
So is the Maltese economy very stable then?
I would think so. The past years have shown that the Maltese economy continued growing during the crisis. We were one of the very few countries to do so.
Okay, well, things seem to be fairly concrete in Malta then. Noel Greamer, editor of the Malta Independent, thank you very much. And finally, over to Slovenia. Boris Černý is Bloomberg News reporter in Ljubljana. Boris, Slovenia's new prime minister claims his country's economy is very different from Cyprus. Is he right to be so confident?
Well, there are. Hello to you and to your listeners. There is a difference. I mean, especially because there's been many comparisons with Cyprus recently since the crisis erupted in the Mediterranean island. The main difference is the size of the banking sector. In Cyprus, it's around 700 or 800% of the country's GDP, while in Slovenia is below European Union average of 135% of the gross domestic product.
But we hear news that Slovenia's dollar bond spiked to a record 6.25% yesterday. Was that following fears that it could go the same way as Cyprus?
You know, I think a lot of what's going on in Slovenia has to do with not a comparison with Cyprus, but the fears of contagion. And since today that they opened the banks in Cyprus and there was no big upheavals, let's say, I think because the latest news is that the US dollar, Slovenian dollar-denominated bond yield has dropped to around 6%. So I think the fear is receding, but one never knows now because many analysts, economists have said, you know, that the taboo has been broken by delving into deposits of people in of the country in the euro region.
Well, Boris Cerny from Bloomberg in Slovenia, thank you very much indeed. And finally, we're joined now by our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. Steve, everybody seems to be very optimistic. Is that just posturing or really are they all okay?
I think there is a little bit of posturing, yes. They all sounded, all the governments of those three countries that we've talked about are on the defensive and have had to sort of try to say, look, no, we're not really like Cyprus. Our economy is very different. But there are two things to note here. One is, essentially, the rules of the game have changed now after the Cyprus bailout. Dijsselbloem may well say, oh, well, this was a one-off. But frankly, if you'd asked 2 weeks ago, what would happen with Cyprus? There's no way they would have said anything like this would have happened. So I think Luxembourg, in particular, the fact it is, its financial services are so huge, are so important that if that goes, then the whole economy can go. And frankly, the stage we're at, these small economies could have a real effect all over for the whole of the Eurozone.
Well, Steve, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House, live from London. The time is 18:12. Coming up, we'll be having our Thursday media sector roundup and we'll be serenading Boston's outgoing mayor after his record-breaking two-decade term.
Taiwan's southern port of Kaohsiung is the topic of our latest Monocle film. Once a neglected sibling to Taipei, we visit a city attempting to balance industry with livability.
Kaohsiung is most intriguing in that it's no post-industrial town searching for a new reason to be. Rather than move beyond its industrial roots, Kaohsiung is aiming to show that it can sculpt a city that people want to live in without sacrificing its role as the industrial heart of Taiwan.
Taiwan, turning the tide on Monocle.com.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from Beirut to Bogota, Sydney to Singapore.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dan.
From Monaco. I'm Sheena Rossiter.
From Monaco. In Hong Kong. I'm Liv Levitchnik.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
In Bogota.
So whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the ateliers of the best design companies, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24. Keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. Britain's newspaper industry, which has struggled to work out how to deal with the digital realities of the 21st century, seems to be edging further towards online payments. The Telegraph and The Sun, papers at either end of the spectrum this week, both announced paywalls. At the same time, another aggregator site, BuzzFeed, prepared to launch here too. Monocle's Steve Bloomfield spoke to Helen Lewis, deputy editor of the New Statesman, about this and other big media stories.
So the Telegraph announced this week that it's going to start charging. It's $1.99 a month, although it's going to keep its blog section outside the paywall for now, which is quite an interesting admission that most of the traffic for that comes from sort of social, so which would therefore be completely killed off by a paywall. And then The Sun has now said that it's alone at the moment in the News International titles in not being behind a paywall. It's going to go behind one too in August. It's clinched a big deal about football, and it thinks that people really like football. They're going to want to read about that, and they're going to be willing to pay to do so. So what's quite interesting about this is now that a third of newspapers in the US, a third of US dailies are now paywalled. And it does seem to be that there's a recognition that actually we all hoped that internet advertising was going to be able to pay for high quality content. That's maybe not happening. You see a lot of newspapers online are going very heavily into video, and that's because they can sell what's called pre-roll adverts on those. So, you know, you have to sit through them to watch a video, and they can get a decent kind of monetary rate on that. But generally, advertising rates are incredibly low, and they're just not enough to sustain original reporting or, you know, great columnists who demand a really big salary.
I mean, there's a, I've always felt there's a sort of a bit of an ethical issue here as well, in that, you know, it costs money to create journalism, and so therefore people should pay for it.
Well, that's my really big worry is that, you know, the sites which we see massive growth in at the moment are ones that, for example, like BuzzFeed, like Mail Online, like Huffington Post, that do an awful lot of aggregation, which is effectively taking content from elsewhere, you know, repackaging it, making it kind of look sexier, putting it into lists, but they're not necessarily so good at generating their own original traffic. And that's fine, but somebody's got to do the stories in the first place. Somebody's got to do that legwork. And you can say that a lot of it's taken from social networks like Reddit, for example, but a lot of it comes from the New York Times, from the BBC, from the Guardian. Now, obviously, the BBC in Britain is in a happy situation of getting its funding from the licence fee, but that's not the case for other places. And there is a slightly parasitical element to some of the traffic getting that happens on newspaper websites.
There is indeed. I mean, we've often sort of talked about how, well, you know, can the Telegraph go, you know, put up a paywall because then everyone will just read The Guardian or The Independent. Do you think that actually, even if all the newspapers in the UK were to put up some form of a paywall, you'd still have this issue that you get these aggregators that people could go to instead?
You do, and there's nothing to stop anybody, say, at the Huffington Post reading all that morning's papers and giving you a digested version of them. And what they have to hope is that they can sell convenience. And that's, you know, where something like Apple, most of us are very happy to kind of go and buy an app and you tap a button, 69p or whatever leaves your account, you know, and it's just for the convenience of being able to play that on the device and access it very quickly. And that's the hope with some of these paywalls, is that they will take advantage of the fact that people want someone else to curate all their news for them. If you like, you know, the Telegraph's political stance, if you like its writers, are you going to be willing to say, well, okay, I'll hand you over $1.99 a month and you'll bring all that to me and I don't have to think about it? I mean, I think it's very hard for journalists because we sort of assume that everybody reads everything.
They do, though, don't they?
And I think that people increasingly get their news through their friends, through their Facebook feed, so they are a bit more kind of promiscuous in what they read. But there are still a lot of people who just, you know, even I find it remarkable, who just only read through their news through Yahoo, say, because it's their homepage. So I think that, I hope that, you know, that this is a more sustainable model, and it does tend to suggest that there is a way forward through giving away everything for free, which has led to enormous numbers of layoffs in recent years.
Indeed. You mentioned aggregators. Let's talk about the UK launch of one of those, BuzzFeed. It's been huge in the US. It's essentially been the Huffington Post of the last few years. What's the secret to its success, and can it replicate it outside of America?
Well, its secret to its success is, first of all, lots of pictures. Again, we know from Mail Online that people do like looking at pictures.
Yeah.
Little, what it calls listicles. So it'll do, you know, the 43 people you can't believe exist. And a lot of that it will very cleverly curate from sites like Reddit. It's basically decided to go for the opposite tactic to the Huffington Post. When that launched in the UK, there was a massive press launch. You know, sort of loads of celebrities flown, and Kelly Osbourne was there. And BuzzFeed's taken the opposite tactic of just being very quiet. It's hired a guy from the NME to edit its website, so it's obviously going to have a very pop culture focus. And there is a lot of mileage in it, and simply redoing all the things it did for its US audience. For example, you know, kids' TV programs you loved, you know, Where Are They Now, and finding loads of pictures, and just regionalizing that content for the UK. My question about it has always been, is there, you know, once you've driven through all the issues of smash hits in the 1990s. You know, what
do you run out of things to do? Well, then you've got Looking.
Well, I guess, yeah, but is the nostalgia mine infinite, or is it going to run dry at some point?
Well, indeed. And one other question on BuzzFeed. Are they going to pay people?
Well, this is at the moment, they operate this kind of, which I think is a slightly better model, but they have in-house writers, so they're not asking people necessarily to write for free, but they're not paying people for use of their photo and often. And that is a slightly sticky point, is that if you create a great viral photo and it gets picked up lots of places, should you expect payment for it? At the moment, you'd be very lucky to get any from anywhere.
No, indeed. Very quickly, just before we go, there's been a Doctor Who, which is a great British institution and is now shown all over the world, including in the US, comes back to our screens this weekend. But there's been a bit of a discussion about the lack of women writers.
Yeah, there hasn't been an episode written by a woman since 2008, which was 60 episodes ago. In fact, since they rebooted it, there's only been one female writer since 2005. Now, you might say, well, why does this matter? You know, writer's a writer. But it's quite interesting that, you know, somebody like Russell T. Davis, for example, who was who's gay, who was a big gay rights campaigner, definitely brought a sensibility to that show that was very gay-friendly and made advances. Now, you might say that he's taken his personal experiences and he's put them on the show, and that's what writers do. And if you're not addressing 50% of people's experiences, you know, if you're going to write a story, for example, Amy Pond gave birth in the last season, but that was written by somebody who had never had that experience, would it have been deeper? Would it have been more interesting to hear a female writer's take on that? I don't think that, you know, you can necessarily say that there are some subjects that women are better writing about, but it does seem very odd to have a show where, you know, you don't get 50% of people's experiences represented.
That was Helen Lewis, Deputy Editor of The New Statesman, talking to our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, earlier. The longest-serving mayor in Boston's history, Thomas Menino, announced today he was stepping down. 70-year-old Menino, who has held the post for two decades, was the overwhelming favourite to win a record sixth term, but a series of health problems have taken their toll. Menino earned the nickname the Urban Mechanic for his transformation of the city. As the New York Times noted today, commercial and residential building is booming across the city. More people are moving into Boston than are moving out, and the city is riding high as the home of an innovative economy, particularly attractive to technology startups. Well, Barrett Austin, our associate editor, joins us now from Monocle's New York Bureau. Barrett, a sad day for Boston?
I think so. I think the city is filled with sad faces. As you said, he's been in office for 20 years. He took office in 1993 in one of America's oldest cities. He served the longest term as mayor. I think there are no doubt sad faces across the city. With that being said, you mentioned the fact that he's had a number of health issues over the past couple of years. I think that should he run for re-election, I think he would probably win. But that being said, there is a sense in the city where people really are sort of searching for new leadership. And I think, you know, maybe his time has come.
He's been credited with transforming Boston from one of America's oldest, historic, but perhaps also slightly fuddy-duddy cities into somewhere with a lot of hope, particularly in the economic sector. What exactly has he done? What will he be remembered for?
I think there are a number of things. As you mentioned, it's sort of seen as one of America's great old historic cities, sort of in the same sense that a city like Philadelphia might be remembered. And with that being said, I think he's really done his part to shepherd the city for the past decade, and particularly over the past 5 years, as so many cities across this country have faced real challenges as a result of the economic downturn. If you look at Boston, skyscrapers are being built. There's a tremendous amount of commercial development, residential development, both in the city's historic core and else, you know, beyond into the suburbs. Beyond that, you have a number of technology businesses that are coming into the city. The city's universities are just as strong as ever. Boston is very much a college town, and I think that many of Boston's universities are as well regarded today as they have been at any point in the past, you know, 50 years or so.
And his strengths seem to lie particularly with his political organisation and his ability to raise money. And as you mentioned, at a very difficult time, particularly in the last 5-6 years, Is it going to be difficult for someone to step in and have the confidence of his constituency that Mr. Menino has gathered and snowballed over the last two decades?
Well, I'd say at the very least, whoever will take his place has very, very big shoes to fill. Mayor Menino is someone who has always been remembered as someone who really gets out and gets to know the people of Boston. I was shocked when I was looking at poll figures that something like as many as 50% of the people polled with regard to his time as mayor had actually met the mayor. And I don't think that's something that could be said for, say, somebody like Michael Bloomberg. You know, here in New York, very few people have contact with the mayor. And in a place like Boston, to hear that, I mean, it's really quite inspiring.
He's shaken a lot of hands in his time. Do we know anything about who is going to be running and who may take over, presumably after two decades and such a huge confidence of people in his constituency? It's sort of going to shake up what could have been quite a stagnant political scene.
I think so. Boston will always be remembered as a very political city. That being said, I think Mayor Menino had such a strong sort of political brand that no one had really even thought about challenging him. You know, he at 71 years old, he probably could be reelected for a sixth term. There's one name that you hear a good bit about, and it's the city councilor, a guy named John Connolly. He's the only person who really had the sort of wherewithal to come out and say, you know what, when Menino runs for his sixth term, I think I'll go head-to-head with him. That being said, all of the polls that anyone had commissioned in the city showed that Menino would absolutely dominate Connolly. But that being said, I think he's probably the name at the top of the list right now. But there, you know, there's still time. Menino will still be in office through the remainder of this year. He'll leave next year at age 71. So there's plenty of time for other figures to get into the race.
Finally, Barrett, it's sort of odd for us over in London. I mean, we have a bit of a fool for a mayor at the moment. but it seems that in the States, mayors not only serve much longer terms, but also really achieve a sort of cult of celebrity status in their cities, which Mr. Menino definitely seems to have had. What is it, do you think, about American cities and the position of mayors that lets them get to that point?
I don't know. I mean, it's somewhat of a tough question to answer, but I think that being said, he is very much a celebrity in the city. He's met so many of the people in the city, and I was surprised when I was reading something earlier. They were comparing it to Ted Williams, the legendary Boston Red Sox baseball player who played for 20 years. They said it's kind of like the Ted Williams moment when, you know, this great Boston figure is stepping down after 20 years in office. You know, sad faces across the city, and he's one of the few figures in this country that has achieved that level of celebrity. But still, I mean, you look in a place like New York and Bloomberg is very much a household name. People really look up to him. Plenty of people despise him. But you, across the country, you have mayors who really come in and shake things up. They're some of the few politicians, I think, that actually can be quite earnest with voters. They don't worry so much about re-election in the same sense that legislators do. There's a lot less politics involved in the sense of worrying about re-election for mayors, I think.
Well, Barrett Austin, our associate editor in our New York Bureau, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. And it's 18:28 here in London, time now for a brief musical reprieve. And who else could we call on but Boston? This is More Than a Feeling. Boston there with More Than a Feeling. You're listening to Midori House. It's 18:30 in London. In the next half hour of the programme, we discuss two of Britain's greatest institutions, the Tube and the weather. But before all that, here's David Spencer with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. Former South African President Nelson Mandela is said to be responding well to treatment after being admitted to hospital for further treatment on a recurring lung infection. He spent nearly 3 weeks in hospital in December with the same lung infection after surgery to remove gallstones. Cyprus says that tight capital controls will remain in force longer than expected as the island's banks reopened for the first time in 2 weeks. They were shut after the government was forced to accept a tough EU rescue package to avoid bankruptcy. Lawyers for Oscar Pistorius have successfully appealed for his bail conditions to be relaxed. The Olympic and Paralympic athlete will now be allowed to travel abroad and will no longer have to report to a probation officer. He's accused of murdering his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, in February. Syrian media is reporting that mortar fire has hit the University of Damascus, killing 15 students. Officials blamed rebels for the attack. Meanwhile, the United Nations Refugee Agency says it is very worried by reports of mass deportations of Syrians from Turkey. The Turkish government has denied a claim that it had sent hundreds of refugees back to Syria after clashes with military police at their camp near the border in a protest over living conditions. Boeing says it is confident that a proposed battery fix on its grounded 787 fleet will see the planes back in the air soon. But the manufacturer has described the grounding as frustrating. Regulators grounded all the planes in January after separate battery incidents on planes in the United States and in Japan. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, David. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Now, one of the more charming national characteristics of the British is our obsession with the weather. Whether home or abroad, you can always count on a Brit to begin any conversation with a musing on the elements. While some might say it's because we've nothing else to talk about, more sympathetic scientific analysts argue it's because our fair island has such a variable, unpredictable weather system. There's always something new to be discussed. One of Britain's greatest nature writers, Richard Mabey, has penned five essays, published together by Profile Books, in a tome called Turned Out Nice Again, on living with the weather. In the book, he expresses and explores his own personal fascination with the elements, and he joined me earlier in Studio 2 to talk me through it. Maybe you could start by telling us where your fascination with the weather comes from a personal point of view.
I think it comes from two quarters. One is the fact that I'm profoundly weather sensitive myself. These last few months have been not pleasant for me. And so really quite early, I got to kind of asking questions about why certain kinds of weather affected me in the way that they did. Why did wind make me feel frazzled? Why did they so often seem to happen on the same moments of the year? And that sort of feeling began to find its way into a nature diary, which I kept, which reflected weather in another way. It was to do with when I found the first celandines open and when the first swifts arrived. And very often this seemed to be connected with changes in the weather or with changes in the weather which had prevented certain things happening. And at this point, interesting links began to form between my own psychological reflection of weather patterns and the natural world's reflection of the weather, and began to ask questions about why that might be.
You make a very clear distinction throughout the book between weather and climate, but what you've just described there seems that sort of when you stand back from your own recordings of weather, that it does indeed kind of say something about climate change in general. Is that fair?
I think climate is something quite big and is not, in this country, perceived at our sensory nerve endings, if you like. If you live in a part of the world where both the weather and the climate are severe and predictable, if you live in the Arctic Circle, you know precisely that you're going to be under snow for 9 months of the year. If you live in the tropics, you know when the rainy season is going to occur, when the dry season is going to occur. These are predictable parts of climate. They manifest themselves as weather, as rain coming out of the sky, as snow lying or whatever, but those conditions are much easier to adapt to, both psychologically and culturally. You can acclimatise physically, you can build institutions and machinery and houses which are capable of coping with those predictable things. We have a lot of trouble doing that here because the nature of where our landmass is, you know, in the Atlantic Ocean on one side and a huge continent on the other, generating all kinds of weird currents, means that our weather is a lottery. And we scarcely have anything that can be called a climate except that it's temperate, you know, that it never goes to extraordinary extremes.
You mentioned there that weather in Britain is incredibly variable, but also actually quite sort of dull
in terms of not really having the extremes that you mention in sort of the Arctic, for instance. Why are we so obsessed with weather, do you think?
Well, I think I would dispute the idea that it's dull. Maybe I'll come back to that in a minute and give some instances of when it is certainly not dull. But I think why are we so obsessed by it? It's the one circumstance of our life that we all experience in common. And since it does affect us so much physically and emotionally, it seems to me completely natural that we should chat about it so much, and that there is a kind of social mannerism that the one thing you can safely greet a stranger with is a banal remark about the weather, which is what the book is called after, you know, it turned out nice again. Why say it? But it forms a social bond, joins two people's common social experiences. And this, by extension, I think goes into the times that we're having weather that we're not used to, because we have no chance to get used to it, like this winter. I mean, we should be talking non-stop about this weather.
I think most people are.
and working out. I mean, the one thing about our weather chat is that it never really becomes creative discussion. It would be great if it led to better ideas for the kind of things that we wore, better ideas for kind of new entertainments outdoors. But it doesn't. We just sit and watch, usually moan, occasionally have ecstatic delight. But
indeed. No, you, for a long time, kept your own weather records, didn't you? As did my father. And I was always intrigued, and I never asked my father what the point was. He collected weather records every day for 40 years, mm-hmm. really to no end at all. is this similar to you? Why did you stop?
I think it's slightly obsessive. I think it's any kind of diary is an attempt to anchor yourself in the changeability of life and the world. And if you are somebody who notices or is affected acutely by the weather, then to put it down in some way anchors you in the fact that you are living in this turbulent atmosphere, which is both, you know, psychological and physical out there. So I think that would be the deep reason why I, and probably quite a lot of people, keep weather journals. I mean, I think a lot of people keep them for purely scientific purposes. You know, they can be extremely interesting and absolutely essential in that vector as well. And historians who've done long-term analyses of weather diaries, which go back to the middle of the 17th century, have found extraordinary accuracy in the patterning of waves of weather. You know, not quite climate, but maybe a 10-year spell of good summers and then a 10-year spell of the kind we've had recently. And this is reassuring scientifically as well as very valuable.
That was Robert Mabey, author of Turned Out Nice Again on Living with the Weather, talking to me earlier there. You're listening to Midori House. It's 18:39 here in London. We'll be back right after this to talk tube maps.
Ever thought of shaking off those golden handcuffs? Or had a daydream about going solo, striking out, far from the gentle plod of your day job? Then it's time you tuned in to The Entrepreneurs. Every week, we meet the brave, intrepid, sometimes bodacious businessmen and women who have done just that.
What we're trying to do is not create a fragrance, but rather evoke something through scents.
It's a show that allows you to learn business nous by example. So, if you want to learn how to open a thriving organic bakery, patent a savvy invention, set up an artisanal microbrewery, or export a finely crafted product to the world, The Entrepreneurs is a living, working audio Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet. If you're looking for a present for a loved one, something for the home, or some luggage to take on the road, why not visit one of our shops? Our beautifully appointed shops in London, New York, Toronto, Hong Kong, and Tokyo sell a selection of the fruits of our collaborations with a number of our favourite brands, including Porter, Hackett, Ettinger, Barena and many others too. Plus, we can also help out filling in any gaps in your collection of back issues. So why not visit any of our shops today? You're guaranteed a very warm welcome.
Welcome back to Midori House. It's 1841 here in London. Now, it's 80 years since the London Underground, or tube map, first went into circulation. It was drawn by the engineering draftsman Henry Beck. Beck was nothing if not dedicated to his craft and the Underground. He composed the topographical map uncommissioned in his spare time whilst working in the London Underground Signals Office. It was an enormous success. And the topographical map hasn't just been used ever since to navigate the network. It's become an icon of transport and graphic design. We're joined now by Dr. Maxwell Roberts from the Department of Psychology at Essex University, something of an underground map specialist himself. Dr. Roberts has himself redesigned Beck's map with some intriguing alternatives. Maxwell, thank you very much for coming in. Before we get on to your own designs, this is probably a very large, difficult question, but why has Henry, or Harry, as he's also known, Harry Beck's design been so enduringly successful?
It's because he made such a really good job of it when he first designed it. If you ever look on the internet, you can see lots of amateur underground maps, and a lot of them are really, really awful. But with so little to go on, Henry Beck's design was absolutely fantastic to begin with. He made a really good job of simplifying the network, and he didn't distort topography too much either. So he didn't take London outside of people's expectations and comfort zones.
And it was easy to read, wasn't it? Because I think the sort of designs that had come before were so concerned with having to mirror what was happening in real time and real distance and things, whereas actually the feat of being able to pull together all these stations in a coordinated design that you could read and you could understand, and it still bore some sort of relevance to what was happening above ground. Really, that was sort of Beck's signature, wasn't it?
Yes, he took the complexities of twisting, turning reality and just turned it all into very simple straight lines. And they're not just easier to follow. What he did was he actually gave the network a very clear shape so that people could actually learn about how it interconnected, how the parts related to each other. Mm. So it wasn't just easy to plan a journey, it made it easy to learn about London as well.
And I was reading today, actually, also that he designed one for the Paris metro system, but it wasn't quite so successful.
It wasn't. He made some mistakes on it. He missed out Gare de Lyon, which was sort of one of the most important stations in the whole of Paris.
Perhaps on purpose. It's a bit of a jab at the French. Maybe.
And it was that was incredibly geographically distorting. He practically tilted Paris 45 degrees on its side. And if you could imagine sort of London with sort of marble arch in the sky and Liverpool Street in the basement, then that's what he did to Paris.
Okay, well, London luckily didn't have a similar fate. But you are very interested in the underground. You have come up with a number of new reinterpretations of Beck's map. Where did this fascination come from, or rather the sort of desire to reinterpret it in some way?
Well, it's because I didn't like the designs I was seeing. Sort of about 10 years ago, I was seeing fantasy maps, and they weren't sort of really true to Henry Beck's principles. So, one of them showed the brand new Chelsea Hackney line sort of zigzagging across the page. And we know that Henry Beck thought that new lines should be dead straight to sort of really advertise their presence. And so I thought, well, if I don't like it, I can either complain about it or try it myself. And that sort of began a very long journey, sort of learning about these maps, what they're for and what you can do with them.
And have any of your designs been successful enough to be incorporated?
Not officially, no. I've shown my designs to people at London Transport, and they say pretty well that they're perfectly happy with what they've got. And we test our designs as well, and we have designs which are easy to use, and not only easy to use, but sort of follow the conventional design rules, so they won't upset or surprise people either. But
so when it comes to conventional design rules that you mentioned there, I mean, what are those exactly?
Horizontal lines, vertical lines, 45-degree diagonals. So virtually every map since Beck's time has use those in London. Been a few aberrations, but not many.
And was that something that Beck just struck upon by accident, do you think? And was he lucky that it just resonated so much with the public that it was so successful?
They fitted London 80 years ago very well. Beck would have been doing this on a drawing board, so he would have had right angles and set squares and things. So, you know, he didn't have the facilities for something strange like 22 and a half degrees. Mm. But, yeah, so yes, but having found those angles successful, they then persisted with them, although they did try 60 degrees once, and there's a very strange map from the 1960s which had an angle of 42 degrees for some reason.
Now, one of your designs that people have fallen on has taken that straight line thing and really thrown it on its head. It's all circles. Tell us a little bit about where that came from, the idea for that.
Well, now that the overground network's been completed, you can go from Clapham Junction all the way around to Clapham Junction again without going through central London. And there's a lot of people saying that why not emphasise this by showing this as a circle? And I've seen some attempts which weren't really exploiting that to its full advantage. So I sort of tried to think, well, you've got circles, how are the straight lines going to communicate with circles? And the answer is, well, the only way they'll really work with them is if they're sort of spokes. So then you get lines either radiating out from the middle or circling the middle, and then the whole map just falls together and you get something very, very powerful from that.
Powerful visually, and in many ways it seems like more of a sort of artistic exercise than something that could be implemented as a practical map. Is that fair?
In some ways, yes. I designed that map as sort of a little bit of a joke, so I was very surprised at how much it captured people's attention. And if you get a design that's so powerful that people just want to look at it, then actually that's sort of half the problem of making a map publicly acceptable. And if they're really sort of studying the design, then they're learning about the network. It's a very coherent design. It really organises London very, you know, very, very successfully.
Finally, Max, Harry Beck was paid 5 guineas, apparently, for his tube map. Is that true? It's definitely not fair.
It wasn't very much money, but he was working for London Transport, so he was drawing a salary. I mean, if he quit his job and then said, oh, now do you want to buy the map for me? It's going to be £100, then... But company loyalty was strong in those days.
Yes, it's definitely a rule not to do a job as a favour on the side. Well, Dr. Maxwell Roberts from the Department of Psychology at Essex University, thank you very much indeed for coming in. We're going to have a song now, and who else could we play but Girls Aloud with their debut single, Sound of the Underground. That was Girls Aloud with Sound of the Underground. It's 1851 here in London. You're listening to Midori House. It's just 1 week before the design industry descends on Milan for the annual Salone del Mobile Furniture Fair, and just 2 years before an even greater crowd lands for the 2015 Expo. But last week, Mayor Pisapia unceremoniously dismissed the brilliant urbanist and architect Stefano Boeri from his post as Councillor for Design, Fashion and Culture for the city. Boeri himself stood against Pisapia as mayor at the last election and, many would argue, has done more to open up the city than the mayor himself. Today, news came that an open letter signed by some of the city and the world's greatest names in art, design and architecture have called on the mayor to reinstate Boeri. Signatories include Marina Abramovic, Zaha Hadid, Rem Koolhaas, Jean Nouvel, Hans-Ulrich Obrist, the list goes on. Well, joining us to give his take on the matter is our Milan correspondent, Ivan Carvalho. Ivan, Stefano Boeri seems to have been quite a sort of controversial figure in the mayor's household. Why is this?
Good evening, Hugo. Yeah, Stefano Boeri ran in a primary in the centre-left party against Pisapia, who was a former lawyer, more sort of the traditional left, and Stefano Boeri being in the past, well, he's an architect for one. He was editor of Domus, the very well-known monthly of architecture and design that started here in Milan. And he cohabitated with Pisapia in the city council as councilman for culture and design. He was also had the job of running the expo, but he and Pisapia haven't seen eye to eye, and he lost the portfolio for the expo last year, and then this just recently happened, and it was caught by people by surprise because people, a lot of locals were pleased with the work that Stefano Boeri has done to raise Milan's cultural profile, especially, you know, in the contemporary art, et cetera.
And so on what grounds has the mayor dismissed him, if everybody sort of knows that there have been some rumblings of just a personal conflict between the two? But surely that's not enough just to get rid of someone, is it?
No, I mean, there is a bit of probably jealousy involved, but also this talk about, you know, the budgets, because now Italy under austerity, like in a lot of places in Europe, and so the tightening of belts was seen as an excuse to cut him loose, stating that you know, they didn't have enough funds to do all of these exhibits and other initiatives that Boeri thought was important to do. Now, Milan, as a budget for the city, they only have about €800,000 to run major events, major exhibitions. While Boeri was very actually active in getting private support in the last year, up to €13 million. So people were saying that you know, he was doing a lot on that end to help promote culture. So it was kind of a shock. And as you mentioned, there was this letter by a lot of luminaries in the world of art and architecture saying that Pisapia should reconsider.
And how likely is it that this letter, as you say there, luminaries, it seems like hardly anyone isn't on that list in the world of architecture and art and design. How likely is it that he will listen to it and, with his tail between his legs, rehire Boeri?
I don't think at this moment it's going to weigh too much on him in terms of making that call and retreating from his position, because you know, he's in a difficult spot. He's had some difficulties passing. You know, Milan has this congestion charge in the city center, and that's been a bit of tension for the mayor in terms of trying to keep that, with local business people being a bit upset about the drop in traffic and business people coming into the city center. And for the moment, with Expo, he had a deal with the center right, because the center right, it's traditionally runs Milan and the region of Lombardy. It's traditionally a stronghold. So with the Expo situation, he decided to make an agreement with the outgoing governor, who was from Berlusconi's party, to run an expo that's more traditional with the classic pavilions, whereas Boeri wanted something that was, since the theme was about agriculture and feeding the planet, he wanted something more interesting, showing, more innovative, showing different types of cultivation methods, from how they do it in developing countries to technology in the Western world. And those kind of ideas were all just sort of brushed aside for more of a traditional sort of fair with pavilions, and then developers coming in afterwards try to make some money at the end of it.
I mean, Boeri has a very good cult status within the design and architecture and urbanism industries. But how much is he a man that people know his name of in the city of Milan outside of those industries?
Well, you know, he comes from a family that's quite you know, influential. I mean, he has for example, his brother is an economist with at Bocconi. He's well known to the public. He's also on television a lot as well. So he comes from a very prominent family of architects. And he has been, you know, well known as an urbanist primarily. He doesn't have a lot of built works, although there are some things going up in Milan. For example, this very innovative project with these green towers with a lot of vegetation out on the balconies to sort of build these very, very, very high structures with lots of agriculture there. I mean, those are very interesting. But he's originally known as an urbanist and a theorist.
Mm. And finally, Ivan, before I let you go, how is Milan looking ahead of Salone del Mobile in 10 days, where we'll be doing some live shows?
Yeah, well, this is something that it's interesting that this thing happened just on the on the eve of Salon de Mobile, when the city, as you well know, there's a lot of energy in Milan, and that's something that Boeri was, I think, trying to bring into the city all year round, because Salon de Mobile, Milan really opens up much more than when there's the Fashion Week, because during the furniture fair and design fair, you have people coming through all the neighborhoods, not just in the fairgrounds, and the city really feels like it's the design capital, and I think that was Boeri's plan was to try to bring some more of that, you know, throughout the year to give Milan more of that New York vibe. But we'll see what happens.
Well, Ivan Carvalho will be hearing a lot more from you in the coming weeks with Salone. Ivan Carvalho, our man in Milan, thank you very much indeed. That's all we have time for today. Our producer was Steve Bloomfield. Our researchers were Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alexandra de Kramer and Barbara Feeney. Our studio manager was Chris Fitch. In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, Andrew Muller and Emma Nelson will be back for the Monocle Daily. And our news editor, Tom Edwards, will be back at the same time as Midori House tomorrow. But from me, Hugo MacDonald, thank you for listening. Goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.